Here we go. Look at the book title. It's called Finding Nothing. So I was interested in this Professor Gregory Betz. What is he? He's a professor in the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University. Where's Brock? That's in Ontario, right?
I think it's it's in Peterborough.
No, oh, that's
is
Trent.
It? Trent, you're right, no. Brock. I don't know.
I don't know where that is. But yeah,
it's in Ontario.
St.
Catharines. Yeah, I was going to say, it's still southern Ontario somewhere.
Yeah.
It's not like Laurentian or whatever. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a book called Counterblasting Canada. A bunch of professors write about Sheila Watson McLuhan and other stuff. And Gregory Betz, he did McLuhan's Definition of Art, I think. That was his theme, and it was pretty good. And so I just decided to look into him, and so he did have this book called Finding Nothing, came out a year ago. And what it is, now Gregory Betz is from Vancouver, grew up in Vancouver, I think. I don't know if he was born there. So as an art professor, I guess he's got to make a book. So he decided to pick Vancouver from 1959 to 1975. And McLuhan, you know, made his lecture introducing. Now, there's a lot of sound. What's that? What's the background sound?
It's the East Coast, Bob. Keep going. It's not going away.
Great. Okay. So he, you know, McLuhan made his first public announcement in 58, supposedly, at a conference of radio broadcasters. In Vancouver, he announced the medium as a message. So that's the famous beginning point for the public. So McLuhan, you know, inaugurated something in Vancouver. So Greg takes this theme, and he says McLuhan had an incredible effect on artists and poets and posers in Vancouver from 58-59. Maybe took a year for just sprinkled down from the conference. So his book starts 59. And he's going to, in the book, lay out the incredible tumult of art innovation in Vancouver till 1975. So it has McLuhan as a big influence to these professors at the University of British Columbia and maybe other schools. And because they were just beginning, it didn't have much of a cultural scene in Vancouver, the professors supported any art that showed up. So all the whack job artists, the new guys like Bill Bissett and B.P. Nichol, who later became sound artists and concrete poets and all that, or were beginning even then, they get support from academia. So it was a unique cauldron of creativity and experimentation. So this guy's book begins... Let's see, the chapters. I don't know if you click on it. It says, you know, open, look inside. I don't see anything when you look inside. Do you guys do that? Does it work? You know, they'll have the image of the book in the title.
While you're looking, I've got three deer looking at me right now.
Nice.
Well, I'm going to take that link and put it on Firefox. Maybe that. I don't get access to anything. Do you, Brian?
Nice deers. I'm not like signed up for anything to look at the book, if that's what you're asking. I can just see the cover and the summary.
Yeah, look right. Inside only gives me the cover. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I think that's same as me.
Oh, wait, no, that's not true. I can scroll down. I can see the table of contents, and I can see the introduction of the book.
Look, I click on Look Inside, it becomes a big picture.
Yeah, but you can scroll down to that picture. That's just the cover.
Oh, I see. Inside. Okay.
Good. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so his inside notice, if you go down, you know, you get a picture of a bunch of letters, right? It says small electrical store in Element County. Some artwork there. They didn't,
in flipped about, you know,
pyramid
mirror
form.
Image.
It's like pyramid, right. And then you go down, you get this statement, finding nothing. So this is his introductory statement on the inside page. It's finding nothing, being a treatise on absence, neglect, how the avant-garde lured to see Vancouver or found reason to try, writing on the edge, margin line, feminist birth stories or the birth of feminist stories, the vanguards, it's more of the title, that's a subtitle, I think. Is it a subtitle? Well, actually, when you go to the library, in the book, at the Library and Archives, Canada Cataloging and Publication, where they give the details, Gregory was born in 1975, and he has this title, Finding Nothing, and then that whole stretch of what I'm reading. So the Vanguards, 1959 to 75, a type of collage, concrete, art in unceded territory, indigenous cultures, foreign incursions, surrealist revolts, and other sundry and otherwise subjects. So that's innovative or a little eccentric. Then you scroll down, and you'll see the index, which is good, but are you all doing that? Looking at the
yeah, I'm looking at the table of contents.
Right. So he, what did he got here? So what happened in 1963? The academics and poets had a conference, probably sponsored more by academia, and they invited Ginsberg and Robert Greeley and Robert Duncan, Denise Levertov, a couple other American poets, and they came and did their thing as beatniks, but they're called New American Poets, I think. So this conference stirred things up, you know, got everybody kind of have a sense of community. So you'll see when American literature moved to Vancouver, that's a conference in 63, summer of 63. Then he does a history of Vancouver with modernism, who was around you know, in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s in Vancouver. And what was interesting is Brian Geisen, his mother lived there. So he showed up there at some point. And also his mother lived there. So Ginsberg left the conference in 63 at some point. Maybe other stuff was going on, but he did this narcissistic, isolationist, whatever. He made a move, and he went and visited the mother. And the professors weren't interested in the mother. They didn't know anything about her. I don't think they knew she was there. So that got a lot of attention that Ginsberg went and acknowledged the mother, therefore acknowledging Geisen, and that became the big, you know, news or startling event of the conference. So then people started to pay attention to her, the academics. Then the next, that's chapter two, part three, Finding Nothing, or the avant-garde flowering that was the 1960s. So it goes into the effect of the 1963 conference. And he's calling the book Finding Nothing. So then he does a bit on the problem of nothing, a short interlude on the theory of the avant-garde, and then the vanguards goes into what was going on. Now, Bill Bissett, you guys have heard of him probably, or Brian has at least. And B.P. Nichol, they're out there in Vancouver, so they start doing their eccentric stuff, and the National Film Board comes in 65 and makes a documentary on B.P. Nichol, or maybe Bill Bissett, both of them. I think it's on on Bill Bissett. Who's this eccentric nowhere poet and a painter, and he's hardly acknowledged. But, hey, Greg, you're going to have to mute.
All right.
Yeah, it's too windy. So,
give me a moment.
It's an odd little documentary. So I looked at it, and B.P. Nichol, he's younger. Bill Bissett is from Halifax. He born in 38, 39. And B.P. Nichol is born in the 40s, and he dies in 1988. And I heard, I never got it confirmed by anybody, that he worked on the McLuhan Archives after I did. But I never met the guy. This is
Bill Bissett?
Bill Nickel.
Oh, right, of course, yeah. Yeah, I got it mixed up if you were talking about Bissett or Nickel. But yeah, we had talked about that before, about BP Nickel.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Right, and then in the Coda, they call it the Coda, they go more into the history of Geisen in Europe. He was the only Canadian, a member of the Surrealists, I think, in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So he got around. And you then go to chapter one, which is about the first major poet review called Tish, which is a play on shit. And the first 19 issues, 1961 to 69. So Betz's thesis is he's doing a microhistory. He's going to show this incredible renaissance of avant-garde experimentation and culture from 59 to 75. And I've just finished up, do you see the next page? Yeah, I finished up chapter 7, so I still have to read the conclusion. But it ends up in the 70s, the disillusionment of Kent State, and nobody stopped the Vietnam War. So the general cultural, countercultural demise of 60s enthusiasm. And so it's about nothing. They got nowhere, found nothing. But it's a microcosm of a professor trying to find something to write about. So he makes a big deal out of Vancouver. And slightly what's relevant for us is there's a lot of McLuhan in it. McLuhan is the guy triggering all this stuff. So, you know, McLuhan was known in Toronto and New York and different places, but you had to be part of the avant-garde in the art world to know about McLuhan, sort of, unless you caught him on CBC being interviewed with Robert Fulford. But Vancouver was a McLuhan place and a crucible of applying McLuhan. And they come up with redoing surrealism, redoing concrete poetry, redoing mixed media. They do everything. So to me, it's dinky art, and it goes nowhere. But it's a big deal for Vancouverites and for the hippies and the baby boomers. They actually had quite a scene going on in Vancouver all through the 60s, starting with holdovers from the beatniks. So if you were living in Vancouver, it was probably the best place to be in the counterculture rather than San Francisco, L.A., or New York, they being too big. But to have academia support your craziness, that was unique. I mean, Reagan and them tried to stop it in San Francisco, L.A. The kids were starting to hang out in Sunset Strip, and that got closed down. The merchants went after them. New York had its typical just so many worlds going on in New York. The beatniks and the thugs were just one subculture. So it's an interesting thesis, especially in I find it interesting in the quotes he makes of McLuhan, what he uses. But it's a if you know the great quote in Counterblast, page 31, which we've gone into, what is it? A rapid series of innovations is an ersatz anti-environment. So that comes out in 69. If you knew that quote in 69, you would have been prepared for the problems in 69 to 75. So there's also a lot of Marxists and communists and radicals and anarchists there. They got everybody there, and they got quite a scene going. But as the counterculture dies in the rest of the world, at least as a major phenomenon in the media, they get affected by that. So Betz's thesis is this is a microhistory of a local scene that was influenced by international artists like the Black Mountain College, John Cage, Ginsberg, and all those people, and people in Europe, but had their own unique take on it. Eccentric, they didn't follow the schools. As a matter of fact, after the Vancouver Conference in 1963, the poetry conference, there was a lot of rebellion against Ginsburg and those guys by what they call the downtown group. So the poor, non-academic artists, druggies, hangers-on, the counterculture scene downtown, they got their own magazines going and their own galleries, which the professors hung out with. It was all mixed up. Everybody mixed in with each other, but there were this some kind of dividing line where the academia revolved around Tisch, that journal, and they did Ginsburg-inspired or New American-inspired poetry. But Bill Bishop and V.P. Nickel are quite eccentric in what they're doing downtown. But everybody mingled. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting history of Canada for me. I wasn't aware of the Vancouver scene in the 60s. I don't think I became aware of B.P. Nickel and Bishop until the 70s because of the Four Horsemen, these guys that performed. Another guy named Steve McCaffrey. Now, as you get into the 80s and 90s, everybody seems to know about Steve McCaffrey and Bill Bishop in Toronto. But I never heard anybody talk about Vancouver. And B.P. Nickel and Bishop left Vancouver in the late 60s, early 70s. So they, maybe even earlier, they started operating out of Toronto. There's this famous Canadian poet, Earl Burney. Anybody heard of him? More on
no, McLuhan's. No, I don't recognize that name.
Yeah, he's a guy in McLuhan's generation. And I remember Sue Bone, as a flight attendant in Air Canada, met him one time on the plane and became a friend. So she would tell me about Earl Burney, but he sounded a little old-fashioned to me. This would be in the 80s. So I wasn't that interested, but I certainly knew he was a major figure in Canadian culture. Well, he was part of the Vancouver scene in the late 50s, early 60s. He had his own magazine, I think. So in the book, they list all the magazines, all the movements. It's quite amazing, the activity going on there. So what's unique, though, is that Greg Betts is writing all this knowing that McLuhan is the major big mind, the guy that everybody's artwork can quote to justify. And so he's the hidden ground, or not so hidden in Vancouver. And he admits that it led nowhere. Other than chapter 6 is about the female poets and artists, because they weren't Denise Levertov, American poet, was invited there, and one Canadian female poet, Margaret Avison, maybe someone else. But they were not written up. They performed, but they didn't get put into the Tisch journal that covered the conference and, you know, subsequent issues. So the women were kind of ignored. So this guy, Betts, starts with a novel in 1970 that is designed by Dave Neufeld. The cover is designed by Dave Neufeld. No, wait a minute. Dave Neufeld's father, a famous, you know, 60s and 70s book designer, he did Sheila Watson's book in 1959, and they have a picture of that here. Let's see, the book... this is chapter 6 called Performing Proprioception, and a novel by Audrey Thomas, 1970, called Mrs. Blood. So basically what was new is Audrey Thomas, Daphne Marlatt, and Gladys Hindmarch. They did books in the early 70s focusing on their pregnancy and describing going through pregnancy and highlighting the problems with their radical poet husbands or boyfriends or fathers. They didn't get it. So, you know, women's lib is just starting in 69, 70. These women, actually, they weren't feminists when they got pregnant, but during their pregnancy, they didn't like how their husbands were rather detached and weren't going through the suffering that the women were. So it's an interesting black stain on the culture, the avant-garde culture of the 60s, because the women are, quote, suppressed in the 60s. But with the decentralization and the chaos of the 70s, the women start having a forum. So their books sell and they get known. So that chapter 6 is a good chapter for that part. And then chapter 7 is the finding nothing, the disillusionment. It's called Avant Now and Then, subtitled Locating the Post-Avant. So, Brian, since you're more aware of the counterculture world than Greg, do you remember anything? Did you ever hear anything as you grew up in the 80s and 90s about the Vancouver scene of the 60s?
Oh, no.
Right. So this book is unique for a hidden history of Canada for Canadians, if you're interested in that.
I mean, certainly not growing up, but I mean, even when I was, you know, starting to get into the, you know, BP Nickel appreciators scene in Toronto, I never caught wind of there being some exciting Vancouver scene that had also happened.
Right. And that they came out of Vancouver. You didn't know that, probably.
No, I didn't know that. I just assumed that the Four Horsemen were all, you know, from the local suburb feeder system of Toronto, that they were all from the greater Toronto area, I assume.
So that's what's interesting about this book. It's an important history in Canada's cultural scene, and a lot of people came out of Vancouver and became famous within Canadian culture, at least. But they were interfacing with people all over the world. And people around the world in Paris and that knew of Vancouver, nor more than the Canadians, so to speak, it would seem. And they would come and visit professors from other parts of the world or other poets, artists. They'd come to Vancouver and hang out with these people. So for me, it's all interesting because if I was aware of it, in 69, 70, I'd be out there and I'd be going, okay, people, go to page 31 of Counterblast. This ain't going to work. All right? I would have been flogging that quote. And so McLuhan predicted what Betts, you know, 50 years later, belatedly realizes. He doesn't have that quote so far. I've got one more chapter to read, and he doesn't have that quote. But since he's making a big deal out of McLuhan, he should have that quote in there to show how McLuhan foresaw something. But these are baby boomers, people born in the 40s and late 30s, and they believe in culture and or the avant-garde and beatniks and poetry and mixed media and film and movies. So that created a lot of the cultural wealth of the 60s and 70s. But everybody had to deal with Reagan when he came in as president. And that made everybody, wait a minute, our revolution is going nowhere, and this guy is a simulation. So then that's when Baudrillard and the French intellectuals start to get prominent. They can explain Reagan actually via McLuhan, though it's not that well known throughout the 80s until the 90s when Baudrillard and a few people mentioned McLuhan. So finding nothing means I shall go through the different use of the word nothing. So I go to page 8, and he says, I should add this. There's this idea of cultural erasure. So the indigenous population is not included in the art scene of Vancouver.
Right.
You know, of any consequence. They're ignored. So they're still suffering cultural erasure. They've been erased. They began with the residential schools in the 20s. Remember, the kids weren't allowed to speak the reservation language. They weren't allowed to carry on the culture. And that's a big scandal over the last few years, right? It's been corrected, so to speak.
You can't. Oh, yeah, and it's been officially described, like, you know, officially described as cultural genocide.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically as a compromise between people saying like, well, but we weren't murdering them, and it's like, yeah, but you were definitely erasing something.
Yeah.
You might not have been going after their genes exactly, but everything else you were definitely trying to eradicate, so.
Yes. Yeah. And, of course, in understanding media, I think it is, McLuhan says, in the hot media of the 20s and 30s and 40s, of course you could ignore the indigenous culture. But in the decentralized effect of the global theater and television, he predicted that the minority cultures would start to get attention. So even he predicted that. But back in the 60s, the hip artists, they were aware of the Indians, and they would go into maybe their cultural mysticism. Now, so far, there's no talk about drugs that much. You know, everybody's doing marijuana and LSD.
Yeah, that's like the big topic of the 60s, right?
Yeah, he's not talking about that. I don't see it. He's not talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. He's talking about the literary arts as a professor of culture of art. So that's his bias. But it's a whole missing part of our history. Remember, I'm half Canadian still, right? I've still got a Canadian citizenship. So he talks about the potential erasure of Ginsberg and Creeley and Robert Duncan coming in 63. They could have just taken over the culture of the counterculture of Vancouver, but they don't do that. The Vancouverites are too spunky and they want to have their own local scene. So, but the fact of nothing, one of the meanings is cultural erasure, which happens to the indigenous cultures. But in the 80s, there are certain people in that culture start to rebel. And this one guy, he writes a book or poetry about reappropriating some totem poles that was stolen from his actual area he grew up in as an indigenous person. He reappropriates the totem pole, right, and writes about it. And as things unfold in the 90s and 2000s, he's celebrated for it because now there's an appreciation of the indigenous cultures. But my first, I go to page 8. Where does it say nothing? American poet. Charles Olson is a big influence on the scene in 63. He's a Buffalo poet. I remember Frank Zingroni taught in Buffalo. He knew Charles Olson. And when he invited McLuhan to come speak there in the mid-60s, and I recall Frank saying that Olson kind of mocked McLuhan during the conference. But he dies in 1970, so, you know, he's gone. And McLuhan rules. But where is what? Okay, this is what it says. The Vancouver writers. So the American poet Charles Olson became a hero to many. This is on page 8. In part for his instruction to delve even further into the complexity of place. Like, get into where you're from. Look into localism. He says, man is estranged from that with which he is most familiar. That's a quote from Heraclitus. And Olson says, history is the new localism, a polis to replace the one which was lost in various stages all over the world from 490 B.C. on until any one of us knows places where it is disappearing now. Then Betts writes, the author, the Vancouver writers who followed Olson's instruction became, through this historical consciousness, the first generation to start to reverse the overlapping erasures, the enforced nothings of Vancouver. Except that they weren't. This oft-repeated story also of the singular achievement of the 1960s generation performs its own kind of erasure. Generations of writers had come before the writers of the 1960s, had started the listening process, the documenting, the tough recoil of the blanket of nothingness that colonial eyes cast over a landscape, smothering the people who lived there. Acclaimed writers like Dorothy Livesay, Earl Burney, Malcolm Lowry. I remember Don Thiel liked Malcolm Lowry, quoted an interesting mixed media quote. I think he put out a novel under the volcano, and he says it can be considered an opera. He mentions every kind of art form. So he might be recovering from Finnegan's Wake when he said this in the mid-40s, I think. Malcolm Lowry is listed, Pauline Johnson, Phyllis Webb, Ray Verrill, Ethel Wilson, Annie Dalton, and many others struggle against the weight of the blanketing silence that lay between the Eurocentric literary traditions and the actual land they lived upon. Those previous generations had built the institutions, including the University of British Columbia Creative Writing Program, that attracted the next to come to the city and that fostered the 1960s foment, as will be discussed throughout this book. A new kind of realism was required, one that rushed full-bodied and whole-throated into the present. It was an awkward but completely essential transformational moment, setting up the ongoing decolonial processes that Vancouver still wrestles with today. This book looks at the process by which a generation, working from many local international precedents and foundations, that's the baby boomers, came to see through that devastating erasure and start hesitatingly, errantly, in brackets, in today's less forgiving parlance, still problematically, it's italicized, you hear academics talk with problems, they started hesitatingly to hear the whole field. Certainly this book will revisit many of the familiar narratives of Vancouver's 1960s literary and cultural explosion, but by approaching these stories from a transcolonial vantage, it will also make space for many of the voices lost in the habitual telling of the story of Vancouver's ongoing emergence, finding them in the nothing, and documenting how the transition from colonization to the present moment's attempts at reversing systematic erasure came to be. Then he says, cites his title, Finding Nothing, this book, addresses a scattershot array of 16 years of experimental writing in Vancouver that reinvented the culture of the city and that has helped Canadians at large to reimagine writing here and to bear witness to our internalization of colonial violence. Vancouver is a key site of the transformations that swept English Canada at this time. Indeed, one of the origins of the surge in experimental arts can be traced to a meeting in 1958 in Vancouver, where Marsh McLuhan spoke to a group of broadcasters at the University of British Columbia in the library, in brackets, the very library that would become a center for experimental art under the tutelage of Alvin Balkind. It was in that meeting that he first uttered the phrase that helped inaugurate a new era, "The medium is the message." Shortly after, Vancouver poets and artists began thinking about the medium of their art with a shocking new clarity. They began experimenting aggressively with the boundaries between the arts and aesthetic. They began experimenting aggressively with the boundaries between the arts and established an intermediate zone for art creation whose effects are being felt to the present day. This zone developed into an artist association called appropriately the Intermedia Society, and he has the dates, 1967 to 72. As Alvin Balkind writes of the McLuhan-inspired coalition, they, quote, made one of the first contributions anywhere in the world, and certainly in Canada, to a particular kind of collaborative avant-garde. The element of collaboration was rooted in a strong functional democracy that demanded a loose-limbed, flexible, less structured, cooperative approach to artistic endeavor, unquote. By 1965, says Gregory Betts, the fervor had spread to the point that the University of British Columbia's annual Festival of the Contemporary Arts was themed "The Medium is the Message" in tribute to McLuhan's influence. So this is the festival that Richard Cabell talks about in his McLuhan in Space. That book came out in the 90s, I think, in 93 or so. And Marchand talks about it in his 1989 biography of McLuhan. And Terence Gordon talks about it. But what I found out in this book, the author, Gregory Betts, has a lot of...
Oh, shit.
What's all that? What the hell is that? Is that Greg? author, Gregory Betts, has bought or collected a lot of the artifacts And so he puts a lot of it into his book. Otherwise, you'd never see this stuff. Well, he has an outline of the conference in 1965 around the theme is the medium is the message. And find out where it begins. On page 37, he has the actual handout that the University of British Columbia put out. So it's the Festival of the Contemporary Arts, 1965, February 1st to February 10th, 1965. So look what it says. The medium is the message. This presentation, which is to be held in the armories, so this was the little blurb that was sent around Vancouver for people to be invited to go to this conference. This presentation, which is to be held in the armories, University of British Columbia, on the 3rd and 5th of February, during the Festival of the Contemporary Arts, which had been going on for a few years, is of a special interest since it was born largely as a result of a combination of ideas inspired by events at the four previous festivals. Chief among these inspirations has been the dance group of Anne Halperin. I remember hearing about her in the 60s out in San Francisco or someplace, which appeared here in Vancouver in 1961. Then in 62, the program put on by the magician John Cage together with the Mercy Cunningham dancers. Then in 63, the presentation of the San Francisco Tate Music Center in 63. And then it says, and last year, being 64, the work of Gerd Stern with its emphasis on collage, that's in quotes, on collage combinations of poetry, painting, photography, and sound. Also last year, the presence of Marshall McLuhan, whose brilliant philosophy of contemporary communication media is helping us toward a new understanding of the cogent role these media play in shaping 20th century life. So I knew Gerd had gone up to Vancouver in January, February 64, because he had put on their first mixed media, which became quite famous in the 60s, this mixed media installation he put into the gallery with his buddy Michael Callahan and a few other people. That it got on the cover of Life magazine in the mid-60s twice. So, but they weren't known in 63. And he told me that their exhibition happened right around the Kennedy assassination in November 63, maybe in the same week. But there was this professor or art director or something from Vancouver who was there. But he didn't say anything to this presentation by Gerd Sien, which was anticipating the mixed media of Ken Kesey's TRIPS festivals in 64, 65, 66. The media part, Gerd and them were doing it in 63. But they got a call or a letter from this guy who said, I noticed you had, you talked about McLuhan or had McLuhan quotes in your installation. He'll be coming to Vancouver in February. We're having a festival. Would you like to bring your mixed media stuff up to Vancouver? And he did. So he and Michael drove their stuff, and whoever else is part of the scene, drove their stuff up to Vancouver, and that's where Gerd met McLuhan, and they became buddies and corresponded. And years later, Gerd gave me the correspondence that he had, but when I got the archive stuff, you know, a couple of years ago, 2017. There's a whole file folder of stuff, which I, when I went to Ottawa in the summer, I looked up and copied. But I have the original Xeroxing of the letters themselves that Gerd had. So I was aware of Gerd doing this with McLuhan, and the famous quote that comes out of that in a book on the 100 philosophers that John Brockman put out with the husband of Carolyn Kennedy. The quote is, McLuhan comes up to Gerd and says, well, you know, what you guys just did here with your multimedia presentation is very interesting, but what's it got to do with me? This shocked Gerd, right? Because it was all inspired by McLuhan. And that's when, as people, whoever met McLuhan, experienced, this guy is different. He isn't what you think he is. So he came across as a stodgy old professor to Geared. Not that McLuhan was that. He wasn't. But the young mind of Geared, who was born in 1928 in Germany, but grew up in New York. He was born one day away from Don Thiel in the same year, October 12th and 13th, 1928. And they both grew up in New York. Geared didn't get there until he was six, but his family got the heck out of Germany in the mid-30s, fortunately. So they did well in New York. And Geared's mother's best friend was Henry Kissinger's mother. So that was the beginning of Geared becoming the Forrest Gump of the art world. He bumped into every scene and was part of every scene. And Geared is mentioned on page 198 in From Cliched Archetype, the McLuhan book. Let's see. So when Cavell and Marchand and Terence Gordon's books come out, they all mention McLuhan at this festival. And it's 1965. And in my mind, I have a pretty good memory for these things. No, Geared met McLuhan in 64. Why isn't that talked about? Yes, there's this scene going on in 65 titled The Medium is a Message, but McLuhan isn't there. Or I can't determine whether he's there. It's vague, because everybody mixes up McLuhan being there with him being there in 64. They don't know he was there in 64, and they talk about him being there in 65. So I had that pulse limit all these years since the biographies. What, it's been 1989, 30 more years of me wondering, where did this mix-up happen? Did Geared get it wrong? But here in this book, Praise's book, is a picture of the actual flyer from 1965 where they say that the work of Geared Stern with his emphasis on collage stuff and the presence of McLuhan last year, 1964. Yeah. So this is Bob, the greatest McLuhan archivist. I could write to Cavell. I may have done this. I just discovered this, a month ago. But I can go and tell these people, hey, I think you might have got it wrong. Unless they can prove that McLuhan came in 65, but it doesn't seem that way. He passed through or something, but he was busy. Had other things scheduled. And of course, in 65, he's starting to become really in demand. So I like this book for that kind of stuff, right? I mean,
absolutely.
I don't think Greg Betts knows this problem of 64, 65, unless he's read the books and noticed it. So now Geared, Geared Stern, in San Francisco, they have the local oral history project. Some part of the university scene there, they interview the famous beatniks and people that were part of the cultural scene in San Francisco in the 1560s. And, of course, they do Geared Stern. He was so much part of it. And so it's a long thing that you can get online. Maybe I could find it and post it. It's a great history of everything with Geared. Remember, he discovers Lenny Bruce. He introduces Lenny Bruce to Hugh Hefner. He was the lover of Maya Angelou in the early 50s, when through her jazz club, Maya Angelou's mother had the jazz guys, Charlie Parker and all those guys. Geared met them in the early 50s through hanging out with Maya Angelou. Maya Angelou becomes the poet laureate of Clinton's inauguration, the Clinton's inauguration in January 93. So Geared has a whole history of that, where they had to stay in hotels, black hotels in the ghetto, because you weren't allowed to be seen with an interracial couple in the early 50s in the United States. But he introduced Lenny Bruce to Hugh Hefner, which he said ruined Lenny Bruce. Lenny Bruce couldn't take the fame. And he introduced Marsha McLuhan to Howard Gossage. Think of that. And he said, that ruined McLuhan. the McLuhan that he thought was cool. He didn't think he handled the fame well. And Garrett was a close friend of Ted Carpenter, and Carpenter probably would agree with McLuhan, with Garrett. But people didn't know that McLuhan had that disease, right, where he's blacking out and stuff like that. So there's a lot more to say about it. But this is where Garrett was so involved in everything. And he only found out about McLuhan because a poet woman friend of his was a friend of John Cage. And John Cage gave a copy of McLuhan's Project 69 report for the National Educational Broadcasters. He did it in 1960. Cage had a copy somehow, and he gave it to this female poet who secretly, against Cage's wishes, he didn't want anybody to... Cage didn't want the McLuhan thing distributed, but Garrett got it. So he read it in 61, 62. Hey, Greg, can you mute? And 61, 62... And that made him and his buddy Michael Callahan get these ideas of doing mixed media in the art world. And Garrett is out in San Francisco a lot in the 1560s, even marries a wealthy woman from out there, but he's back and forth in New York. So he comes across the San Francisco Tape Music Center in 62, 63, and he meets the young Michael Callahan, an editor or something there, and so they team up and form ESCO. And that's in 62, 63, and they put on this thing in November 63 in some museum place that leads to the connection to this professor up in, or art director up in Vancouver. The tape, as you see, the Tape Music Center was presented at the festival in Vancouver in 63. Now, I don't know if Michael Callahan was a member of that. He was pretty young. He may not have gone to San Francisco in 63, but he definitely went up in 64 with Garrett. So in this local university project where they interview Garrett, it's a very long thing with all these amazing details of his life. He was even a sound engineer for the Pacific radio station in San Francisco for Alan Watts. When Alan Watts, you know, ahead of everybody, was on the radio explaining his, quote, conversion to Zen Buddhism and all that, even though he was a Protestant minister. Here's Garrett as a young kid, fresh from Black Mountain College in the East Coast, bumps into Alan Watts. So, in this project, oral history that Garrett's giving, he can't remember the name of the professor or director, whatever he was. He implies that he knows it and he'll get it later, but it's not in the book. So I never knew who it was. And I wondered if he was somehow connected to McLuhan's speaking at the broadcasters in 58. Well, nothing gets cleared up until I get to read this page with the memo, because there's the guy who brought him in, a guy named Alvin Belkine. So I emailed Garrett a couple of weeks ago. I said, the professor that you could never remember, is his name Alvin Belkine? That's B-A-L-K-I-N-D. And he writes back, bingo, that's the guy. So I don't know if Garrett ever remembered the name. You know, since way back in the 90s or 80s when he was interviewed, he didn't have the name whenever I talked to him. But we haven't talked about it for 15, 20 years. But Garrett remembered the name, if he hadn't remembered it through the years, I put it in his brain. So there we have it. And this this McLuhan's themed festival, it lists the people who prepared it. So there's a Helen Goodwin in the physical education department, Ian Baxter in the fine arts. He's a famous guy later. David Orcott in extension, Cortland Holtberg in music, Abraham Rogatnik in architecture, Takeo Tanabe in the Vancouver School of Art, Sam Perry is a filmmaker, Roy Kayuka is a part of the Vancouver School of Art, and Helen Sontoff teaches English, and then Alvin Belkine, he's in fine arts. So he seems to be I think I find out he's more of a director of a gallery, but it might be the gallery at the University of British Columbia. I have to look it up. That's an important McLuhan aspect, the Gerd Stern history. Let's see. So back to my notes. Nothing. So on page 8, he refers to cultural erasure as the nothing. Then I read about the, on page 9, how they try to undo, they begin to undo the cultural domination of European art, history, and all that stuff in Vancouver, in the educational system. And then I read his summary of the McLuhan talk, and he doesn't say anything about the nothingness there. He just names his title. Then you go to page 11. He has a subtitle, an article in 2016, What is the Physics of Nothing? For a useful overview of the field of in science, including an array of ways of thinking about nothing as absence, as the pure context for things. In philosophy, it's called Chora, C-H-O-R-A, as cosmic vacuum and so on. So he goes into the other fields' use of nothing, right? It's later probably dark matter.
Right.
So he includes that as part of his meaning, how he means nothing. Then, page 16, he says, it was indeed at one point in the history of Canadian literature, for a significant cohort, exciting to imagine and depict modernist culture arriving into the country as a kind of liberating epiphany that broke